You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. A new book titled Never Trump is based on extensive interviews with conservative opponents of the current president. Now, the book provides a window into the motivations of conservative professionals, as well as a guide to the long-term consequences of these partisans' unprecedented revolt and what it holds for both the Republican and the Democratic parties, conservatism, as well as American democracy. Joining us live today is Boise native and University of Montana political science professor Robert Saldine, co-author of Never Trump. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
So first off, we should note that an excerpt of your book was featured in The Atlantic recently. Talk to us about, you know, how this revolt started. I mean, we are going back to 2016, and really, who were the key players in this?
Right. Well, I think it started when Donald Trump emerged on the scene and embodied so much of what a group of Republican professionals and members of the conservative movement viewed as just the antithesis of everything that they had understood conservatism to be, what the Republican Party stood for, and what they had invested a huge amount of their lives trying to promote. Mm-hmm. And here comes this guy who undermines all of that and threatens all of their work. And you're right. The way we conceive of it is this group is that it's not elected officials. There were some in that milieu. It's also not the American public, although you could also say that there were plenty of voters who identified in some way with the Never Trump phenomenon. But really, the white hot core of the phenomenon, as you suggest, are these what we call these service providers, these networks of professionals within the Republican Party. So we're talking here about all of the people who would normally be staffing a Republican administration, and that includes foreign policy and national security policy experts, lawyers, and economists predominantly. So that's one network. Then you have this other network of public intellectuals, and these are the people who hang out at think tanks, at universities, at magazines, or columnists like George Will and David Brooks, right? That was another constellation. And then you have these party professionals, the people who run the nuts and bolts of campaigns. And that is a huge class of people. And so in our conception, Never Trump isn't exactly a single thing. Each of these little networks have their own unique stories. But that is where you really find the hub of this Never Trump phenomenon.
So then, I mean, to be perfectly blunt, their revolt did not work. I mean, he is the president, and they were trying to back other candidates. I mean, why do you think that failed?
Right. Well, initially during the primaries, I think there was a clear failure to coalesce behind a single alternative, which is, kind of interesting thinking about the 2020 nomination on the Democratic side and how that played out. And in fact, a lot of Never Trumpers were early on saying, Democrats, you got to gear up against Sanders if you want to stop this revolt on your left and get in line behind one person. And on the Democratic side, it kind of worked. But that thing didn't play out on the Republican side. You had, despite the Never Trumpers' efforts to coalesce behind a single alternative to Trump, that's not what happened. And in a way, it kind of made sense from each individual candidate's perspective. They were trying to be the alternative to Donald Trump. And so they were training their fire not on Donald Trump, but on the other people who were vying to be the alternative to Trump. And so you had Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio going after one another instead of Trump. And so you had all these people kind of duking it out. And by the time it got down to just one alternative, it was too late. And then the Never Trumpers tried other things too. They tried to to stop the nomination at the Republican National Convention, and that mm-hmm. failed. And then they obviously had to grapple with the general election. They did run a candidate. They actually targeted and came pretty close to getting some pretty big names. They talked with Jim Mattis. They talked with Mitt Romney, Ben Sasse. And all three of those figures took some time to consider it, but ultimately declined. And I think one thing hanging over all of this is that everybody knew that Hillary Clinton was going to win. So that really right. shaped the way a lot of people understood this. And I think if they had perceived that situation to be a little different, if they thought that Trump was a real viable contender to actually win the presidency, you might have seen people behave differently. But that was one thing overhanging all of this. Everybody just knew that Hillary Clinton was going to win.
You know, and then in the book, you write about a liberal conservative faction. Can you talk about that? Because you don't usually hear those two words in one sentence regarding, you know, a group yeah. of individuals.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, basically what we mean there by liberal is not necessarily what we'd associate with progressives, right? A lot of times those words mm-hmm. are kind of used interchangeably. You know, political scientists understand those words differently, but
but not the general public.
Yeah, well, that's right. But liberal as we're using that term is meant kind of in the classical liberal sense. Of grounded in all these kind of democratic norms that just undergird American democracy. But the basic idea with this idea of a faction is that one of the things that's unique about the last few decades of American politics is that the two major parties have become very homogenous. And that's mm-hmm. not usually the way it works in the United States. It's not the way it works in other countries either. You know, there's a demand out there for more than just two options. And in a lot of other countries, the way you deal with that is you have multiple parties. And so you have a center-left party and a couple parties farther to left, and you have a center-right party and a couple parties farther out to the right. In the United States, because of the way our system is set up, it's very hard. The institutional hurdles to setting up a new party, it's just very hard. And that's why, you know, we've only had two parties for basically all of American history. And we haven't had a new party since the Republican Party emerged on the scene back in the 1850s. So the way we've typically dealt with that demand for more than just two options in the United States is that you have internal factions, organized groups within the parties that on some in some ways work together, at least in trying to win the presidency, but in other ways are very much in competition with one another. And so, you know, to take just a classic example, you know, it was not that long ago when you had an organized group of Southern Democrats who in some ways were quite conservative. And then you had the mainstream of the party that took very, very different views on a number of things, you know, race kind of being the most obvious. But the same phenomenon was going on in the Republican Party. You had various different factions. You had a conservative faction, but you also had a moderate or even liberal faction centered around like Nelson Rockefeller. There was a whole batch of people on the West Coast too. And so, you know, the homogenous nature of our parties right now is very unusual. And so we do think that there's an opportunity. And so one scenario is to have a return to really what has been the norm of factions within parties. And you can kind of already see this maybe starting to happen on the Democratic side with the Democratic Socialists of America centered around Bernie mm-hmm. Sanders and AOC and the Squad. They are starting to form and organize real institutions within the Democratic Party to compete against the mainstream of the Democratic Party. Right. And you can kind of see something like what we imagine on the Republican side in Massachusetts and Maryland, where you have very popular governors who were popular before coronavirus, but very popular Republican governors in heavily Democratic states. And And those types of things, that's kind of what we have in mind, that we could be seeing, you know, if, and it depends on what people do, obviously, but we could be seeing, and at least there's an opportunity for a return to more factionalized parties.
You know, but with that being said, I mean, and you write about this in your book, I mean, this current political climate that we live in, and it's so obvious in so many ways that when we are as partisan as we are, it's almost paralyzing, though, to even try to compromise on anything. And I think, you know, your point to, in particular, the governor of Maryland right now, when, you know, he is a Republican, but speaking out regarding the coronavirus on certain decisions that the president is making right now and questioning that, I mean, just from an outsider observing that, it's almost shocking.
Right. And yeah, you know, I think the polarization point you make is spot on. And you know, one of the and that kind of fuels, I think, a lot of what we've been seeing in our politics. But one of the things that does is it sometimes for people it places their commitment to democratic norms, small d democratic norms, into conflict with their policy preferences. And so when you have a situation where the actual stakes of any given election or the perceived stakes seem to be really high, it forces people to make these kind of trade-offs. So one great example of this back in 2016 was this essay that came out, got a huge amount of attention at the time, called the Flight 93 Election. And the idea was, and this came out from a conservative who was making the case for supporting Donald Trump, and his point basically was, look, this election is an existential thing. If we lose this election, if Hillary Clinton wins, it's all over. America as we know it is over. We've lost the court. We've lost everything. And that kind of typifies a way of thinking that is just so pervasive right now. And when you get to that kind of zero sum situation, it makes people more concerned about that they're going to lose out on the policy they want, and less committed to kind of the basics of democratic norms, of pluralism, of seeing things elections aren't totally zero sum. You know, you lose, you win some, you lose some. And if you lose this one, well, come back and duke it out next time. Right. But that's very different than this mentality that everything hinges on every single election.
So before I let you go, I'm really curious, in your opinion, do you think we will get back to bipartisanship at some point, and, you know, by being able and willing to compromise, frankly, or is this the future of politics?
Well, I think we'll get back to it at some point. You know, I think usually we can go through periods like this, but usually there comes a time where we get past it and kind of view these things in cycles. And I do think one of the ways out of it is to encourage these kind of factions, a return to factionalized parties that we talk of about at the end of the book and in that Atlantic piece that you mentioned. That would be one way out, because once you start having internal factions, you know, some of those factions are going to identify partners in the other party and want to actually legislate and govern with people on the other side. And again, this is not an unusual thing.
It's not a new idea.
American history. It seems crazy now, but this used to happen all the time.
And, right.
And it does seem like the way the parties are situated right now, there is an opportunity for that if people seize it. And it's going to take more than just these one-off people like Larry Hogan in Maryland. You know, he's just kind of a single person right now. And same with Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, and you can point to others. But what it would require is something like what happened with the Democrats, with the Democratic Leadership Council back in the 80s and the formation of that, which kind of catapulted Bill Clinton into the presidency. Mm-hmm. You'd need that kind of building of institutions, building of think tanks and magazines and internal coalitions within Congress, all of those institutions, which are not easy to build. But right. but they've been a part, a feature of American history for most of the country's existence.
Well, we shall see, won't we? Hey, thank you for taking some time out of your day. We've been talking with Boise native and University of Montana, I can't say Montana today, Montana political science professor Robert Saldine, co-author of the new book, Never Trump. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is Idaho Matters.